Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Felicity Sidwell Reed, my co-host, Gwyn Shuttimer, and our guest this week, Catherine Hawley. Each week, we visit with an author from our region. We get an introduction to their work, a glimpse into their lives sometimes. We find out what prompts them to write, and we have an opportunity to hear them read from their work. We're very pleased to have Catherine with us today. Welcome, Catherine. Catherine is an entrepreneur and freelance writer who lives in Port Hope. She has made a name for herself as a journalist over the years, writing a business column and many articles for Northumberland Today and other publications. November 2014 saw the launch of her book, The Fight of Our Life, in which she shares her fight to get appropriate rehabilitation and appropriate care for her husband. 10 days after successful brain surgery, he suffered complications. When a medical team deemed him unlikely to benefit from rehabilitation and sentenced her 56-year-old husband to a nursing home, Catherine began to realize the necessity of being or having your own health care advocate. She's currently working on a new book about adverse events within the healthcare system, and you can find out more about it at www.thefightofourlife.ca. Your book is a very moving one, Catherine, about a harrowing time in your life and that of your husband. When did you decide to write the book, and how did you first set about it?
Well, the seeds of the book were sown when I started keeping a daily journal of Bill's early progress while in the hospital. I was hoping then to find new ways to help him and to make the hospital staff see him as a whole person, not just as a patient or a chart. I started taking pictures of his progress in the hopes that it would help him reestablish memories and to certainly to command a change of opinion among the professionals about providing rehabilitation for him. Through my journaling, I also inadvertently captured the setbacks and obstacles, the miscommunications, and the mistakes that occurred along the way. And I realized I wanted and actually needed to share what we were experiencing and what I was learning about how to get the best outcome from the healthcare system. By being very involved in every step, you get better results. A lot of the things that I wish I had known in the beginning are in the book I've written. Although I didn't start writing the book until much later, the journals in those photo albums served as my very best resource center, and it helped to keep the story, the chronology, and the details true and consistent and authentic.
Besides sharing your experiences in the healthcare system, the good and the bad, and showing how easily things can and do go wrong, your book is also a love story, which shows the commitment, tenacity, and the strength you both had to summon up to face the crises you met during this time. Tell us a little about this aspect of the book. Was it hard to write about it?
Well, it is indeed part love story. Halfway through the first draft, I suddenly realized I couldn't possibly separate the experiences of what we'd experienced in the medical system couldn't be separate from our personal story. Without that very special love that we shared, many parts of this journey would very well have been impossible. So the love story is integral. Our love actually was the fuel that made what we did possible. Without it, we probably would have fared far less well. Mm-hmm. Our strength actually, I think, came from one another. We had a tremendous amount of respect and value and commitment for one another, and that made a huge difference. As to, was it hard to write about? Oh my God, yes. I cried small lakes while I was putting words to paper. But there were also lots of times where I would smile and my heart would flip-flop. And sometimes I laughed out loud. There was also a driving anger for me, though. I was still, in many ways, so angry and frustrated with all the ways that the system had let us down. Mm-hmm. And I had a burning desire to help people not suffer the same blanket coverage that you tend to get in today's healthcare. It became really important to me that I find out how they decide who gets what care and how you make sure that you are one of the people who gets the care that you actually need. So the anger and the frustration actually provided the incentive for me to keep my butt in the chair. And as I keep saying, what you don't know can hurt you.
Yes, yes. So how about reading us an excerpt from The Fight of Our Life, a true story of crisis, hope, and love?
I would love to, Felicity. Thank you. In 1992, my husband underwent surgery for a brain tumor. And we were told, quote, the pathology reports indicated the tumor was in fact a very aggressive type. The prognosis was very, very poor. Quote, no one survives this type of tumor, unquote. But Bill did survive. Fully recovered, he went back to work in the military 5 months after his surgery and just refused to live in fear for the rest of his life. I had come to understand then that prognosis is not an exact science. 10 years later, on December 16th, 2002, we met with Dr. Ellis, the neurosurgeon at Kingston General. He was very serious, detailing what would be involved, but at the same time very positive and encouraging. All that said, I'm confident I can debulk this growth, he said. That was the information we had desperately wanted to hear, had desperately hoped for. The only thing worse than learning you have a very serious condition is being told you have no options. We left the doctor's clinic subdued, but optimistic. We would get through this, just like the last time. Of course we would. The surgery was postponed 4 times, but finally, on January 30th, at 6:30 in the morning, my husband was in surgery. And it was a very long day. Hours later, when I saw Dr. Ellis coming down the hall, my heart started racing. I was petrified he was going to say that something had gone horribly wrong during the operation. Instead, he announced, grinning ever so slightly, the surgery went very well, no neurological damage, and now we just wait to see how things go. I expected the next few days to be relatively uneventful, a gradual move back to normal for my husband now that the tumor had been annihilated, just like the first time. 5 days later, Bill came home with me, walking, talking, and teasing me about having to live off my cooking for a while. 10 days later, though, he didn't wake up. He had lapsed into what's called an unresponsive state. In less than an hour, he'd been transferred back to Kingston General by ambulance. The ER staff examined, prodded, and consulted, compared theories and solutions. A CT scan and a multitude of other tests revealed no definitive explanation. Dr. Ellis spoke with me at Bill's bedside. He said his brain has endured a huge assault through surgery. It might simply be overwhelmed and shutting down to allow further healing. It's not all that common, so try not to worry. We'll keep a close eye on him. I found great comfort in his words, and I knew Bill was in the best possible hands. And several days later, we were on our way home again. But a week later, the crisis reoccurred. Back at KGH on February 24th, I was told that, with tumor and surgery-related complications ruled out, Bill wouldn't be under the neurosurgeon's care anymore. He was being passed over to the neurology department. It was the last time I felt that my husband's care was being managed properly. The next weeks were a series of ups and downs, and I was just stumbling along waiting for Bill to recover. Each doctor's visit in the morning started with, "Hi, Mr. McLeod. Do you know where you are? Do you know what day it is? Do you know why you're here?" My mind, but not my voice, answered for him. "Of course Mr. McLeod doesn't know where the hell he is. He went to sleep in his own bed, in his own home, and woke up somewhere different, surrounded by strangers." By week 3, Bill was consistently remembering where he was. Tears ran down my face, happy tears. The morning he said, "These doctors have crappy memories. They keep asking me the same questions every day." One afternoon, standing in the doorway to Bill's room while orienting a new resident about Bill and his chart, Dr. Lind, the senior neurology resident, said, too loudly, "Oh yeah, that's Mr. McLeod. His brain is fried." I flew into the hallway screaming like a shrew. "Who the hell do you think you are? Have you never studied any psychology? Bill isn't deaf. He and all these other patients hear your thoughtless, offhand, and terribly negative comments. So much for encouraging people to recover." Medically, though, Bill was stabilizing. But new issues came and went. Daily, I reminded the staff about the gains that he was making. Naturally, I focused on the positives. Often, I received a tolerant, patronizing gaze for my troubles. What I soon realized was the wife in denial look. And then, just a month after Bill had been readmitted to the hospital and put in the hands of the neurology staff, I was asked to attend a family planning meeting to discuss the plans for Bill's discharge from hospital. I anticipated that his progress would continue to be steady, if a little slower than ideal, and so I expected that they would recommend, increased therapy to get him up and out and to tell me what else we could do to be homeward bound. I was very, very wrong. I realized that Dr. Lind, who had earlier made the reference about the fried brain, had been a principal in deciding Bill's future. We're going to send your son to a nursing home. He requires far too much care for you to manage at home. Around the table in the conference room were the resident, the occupational therapist, the nurse manager, and a liaison from the Access Center. There was also the social worker, and of course me, the wife. "Pardon me," I asked. "Well, you'll never be able to manage this much care." I interrupted whatever was coming next. "But he's getting better. He's more alert, he's talking more, and he's eating much better. Even the nurses see a big difference in him. He doesn't need to be 100% to go home. We will do whatever we have to do to keep him improving. We need help. We don't need an institution. It's only been a few weeks. You can't give up on him this soon. We will do whatever it takes, but I will not let you do this." Catherine, we all shared our opinions. This is the best thing for Bill. With that, he stood, picked up his notes, said, "I'm sorry," and left. The irony of the meeting's title struck me. How do they have a family planning meeting with no input from me? Apparently, I was supposed to simply accept their proclamation.
Thank you, Catherine. Now we'll take a short break.